we're happy to have Dr. Tressler here today to talk about psychological evaluations. Chris Andriocchi was instrumental in helping us secure Dr. Tressler for this presentation, and she actually wanted to introduce him today, but she is stuck in trial, so she sent me an email of what she would have said. So, Chris writes that Dr. Tressler has been qualified as an expert hundreds of times in dependency, domestic relations, delinquency, and criminal court, and is so well-respected by the judges and both sides of the bar that he rarely has to be qualified. Everyone stipulates to his expertise. The psychological evaluations are the benchmark against which we measure all others, and he is so generous with his time, even to answer questions when he is not a provider on cases. He is the best. He is the best, and we love him here. So I don't think there's an introduction I could give that would top that. But on a more serious note, Dr. Tressler is the founder of Centers for Psychology in Orlando, and they provide direct service and supervision of psychotherapeutic and assessment services. It involves also a private clinical and consulting practice specializing in psychodiagnosis for clinical and forensic purposes. Psychotherapy. He has pages and pages of credentials, and again, we're very happy to have him here with us today. And you will need to, as you can tell from the materials, you will need to have the materials in front of you, specifically the psychological evaluations that he's going to be referring to throughout his presentation. So I'm going to hand it over to Dr. Tressler now.
Well, thank you very much. I didn't know I paid Chris that much to introduce me. I'm happy to talk to you. The essence of what we're going to be talking about here today actually was recorded about a year ago by somebody in the State Guardian Ad Litem program, I guess, for training of new guardians, new lawyers and volunteers, I guess. So somewhere in there, a video exists of much of this same material. Now, I assume that most of the are we interactive here? Are people able to talk freely if they have a question or anything?
Yeah.
Okay. Very good. And please jump right in. I don't necessarily like to talk nonstop for an hour, so I'm kind of hoping that people will contribute and spare my vocal cords a little bit. The issue of psychological evaluations in dependency court is a matter of great interest to me because I do a lot of that. And a lot of my colleagues, some of them very good, don't do much of it and don't like to go to court, do not like to be in the same zip code as an attorney if they can help it. I guess I'm pretty comfortable in dealing with attorneys and in dealing with the legal issues that you all have to deal with every day. And so I guess I have a lot of experience in this. I don't know that experience is necessarily the only thing that's important, but it is at least it puts me in a position to have some interest on the topic. Wanted to mention briefly, because I think this is pretty important, and if you look at the examples of reports that we're dealing with here, you'll understand why. I wanted to deal with the issue of what a psychological evaluation is. Now, technically, any report that a psychologist does that evaluates someone could be called a psychological evaluation. There are two important things to consider. The first of those things is it needs to be done by a psychologist, or it's not a psychological evaluation. A lot of people like to think that they're psychologists or like to consider themselves to be psychologists, and not all of them are. And that's one of the reasons that Chapter 490 actually regulates what a psychologist does. And legally, if someone who is not a psychologist produces something that they call a psychological evaluation, they are technically in violation of the law. I'm not a psychiatrist, so I don't call what I do a psychiatric evaluation. And when a mental health counselor or someone who is not trained as a psychologist says that they're doing a psychological evaluation, I think that is something that we all need to look at with a certain degree of skepticism, if not, in some cases, scorn. A psychologist is licensed as a psychologist. A psychologist always has a doctoral degree. A psychologist carries malpractice insurance. A psychologist specializes in doing certain things. Now, there are people who have PhDs who are not psychologists. In fact, one of the reports that I will be talking about here is by a person who has a PhD. She's a well-trained person in mental health counseling, and she attempts to do what is a de facto psychological evaluation, and it really isn't.
Dr. Tressler?
Yes.
Can I just chime in with a question real
quick?
Sure. I had this issue come up just last week where there was a psychological evaluation ordered, and the mother took it upon herself to go to UCF to their, they have, a clinic program where they're evaluated by a master's degree person. However, it's supervised by a psychologist.
Right.
And our judge ruled that that was adequate because she had administered the testing and because she had done counseling under the supervision of a psychologist, that that was okay.
Well, and it is okay. That's how people get trained. But the person that needs to be on the witness stand in that case is the psychologist who supervised it, put his or her name on the report, and it should be on the report.
Yes.
As the supervisor, as the person who is responsible.
Right. Well, that was my argument. It didn't work. Okay.
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 But,
thank you.
And the other thing is, whoever testifies should also be able to answer for the way things were done, so that that psychologist had better know what went into that report and was just not signing things off as they came across their desk.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Okay.
It's a bottom line issue: who takes responsibility?
Yeah.
And that, you know, quite frankly, every one of us has had some kind of professional procedure performed by someone who is in the process of training.
Sure.
It happens in hospitals, it happens in clinics at UCF, it happens in many places. But the bottom line is you need to know who's taking responsibility for that report. They need to be answerable for it.
Right. Okay, thank you.
The issue of what goes into a psychological evaluation, I think, is pretty important. What distinguishes a psychological evaluation from any other approach to assessing someone's mental health is that it is a systematic and structured way of doing it. Now, typically, the systematic and structured components of that evaluation will include at least three basic things in some fashion. And that will be a face-to-face interview and observation of the person that one is evaluating. And that should contain some description of their gross mental status. If someone comes into my office wearing a clown suit and chews on their toes during the evaluation, that's important. If the person behaves normally, that's important. If there are no aberrations, and yet we have a police report from last week showing that the person was walking nude down the middle of Main Street, that's important. So an observation of the person's mental status at the moment of the evaluation, as well as a description of how they're functioning, how they're doing subjectively, and what they're demonstrating objectively in a face-to-face interview. That's an important part. Another important part, and it's not always available in to the degree that we would like, and that is collateral information, some kind of third-party information that at least states what the allegations are, what the concerns are about this individual, child or adult, doesn't matter, but we need some kind of collateral information when possible. The more objective that information is, the better. For instance, if I'm evaluating a child and the parent who wants to be, let's say in a custody case, and the parent who wants to be the custodial or the primary residential parent is the one who's informing me about the child's functioning and about the relationship between him or her and the child, the more suspect that information is. But the information that I may get from the child's therapist, the information that I may get from the child's teacher, from neighbors, that may be more objective and perhaps more important. And then finally, what distinguishes a psychological evaluation from any other approach to assessment is the use of standardized psychological tests. Now, there's nothing magical about a psychological test. It just has certain characteristics to it that are intended to reduce error. Now, this is, I don't want to lapse too much into scientific speak here, but the whole purpose of any scientific inquiry is to reduce error. And we reduce error in a number of ways. One way, very simple, is that when we use a procedure, no matter what kind of test it is, it's always given in a standardized manner. If, for instance, I give a test in a quiet office where there are few distractions and where the situation is fairly comfortable and where people are not talking to this individual in the course of them taking the test, and that is, if that is consistent with the standard procedures, it's going to yield results that are more likely to be valid than if the person takes it at their kitchen table at home with their husband helping them. That's not a standardized procedure. You'd be surprised at the number of times I've seen psychologists send tests home with people to take. When they do that, they not only violate the standard procedure, they have no way of knowing whether it was the examinee or their spouse or their boyfriend or girlfriend who actually answered the questions. So it's given in a standardized way. To make it a test, it should be published and peer-reviewed. That is, that it has other psychologists who have studied it, looked at it, and been able to weigh in on the structure, form, and content of the test. It should be able to be interpreted in a standard manner. If I invent a test that only I know the answers to and only I can provide any interpretive explanation for, then it's not really very valuable. It should be interpreted in a standard manner so that if the person who is similarly trained across town gives the same test, they should get same or similar results and interpret it in pretty much the same way. And in legal terms, a simple way to look at whether a test is a test and usable, particularly in connection with any court proceeding, is could it pass the Frye test? Is it something that most people of a similar profession in the community would commonly use to answer a particular question? That's what a test is. Psychological evaluations contain tests that can be used for a variety of things, such as assessing intellectual functioning, achievement functioning. There are tests that help us with emotional and personality functioning, and that is not to read minds and to necessarily say whether a person is a type A or a type B personality, but to determine whether there are significant symptoms of depression, anxiety, thought disturbance, mania, introversion versus extroversion, and various factors that may be important in answering questions about that person when we go into court and talk about their status. The tests may also take the form of so-called projective tests. I'm not real high on them. I do use them, and there are times when we have to, such as the classic Rorschach test, which is a series of ink blots to which the person gives responses, and the Rorschach can be scored, and it can be interpreted in a fairly standard way. It's just that the reliability and validity data have really never been fully established. Other kinds of projective tests that may be used include sentence completions, picture drawings, and storytelling tasks such as the thematic apperception test. These are still standardized measures of, or standardized methods of gathering information. What they lack is a good, reliable, and valid mechanism for scoring and interpretation. Now, the collateral information that is particularly useful in cases where we are going to have to ultimately answer some kind of a legal question include such things as the dependency petition. Now, that's kind of controversial among defense attorneys because the dependency petition is essentially an indictment. It is a series of allegations as opposed to a well-structured factual situation. It is allegations. Judicial reviews, I find them to be pretty helpful because the judicial review usually comes somewhere down the road after people have had a chance to look at a dependency case for a while, and it starts to really gather a little bit of history. Sometimes court pleadings. People will say, for instance, something very different on the stand one day than they say in my office. Or they will allege something in a pleading that is very different than what they say when they're in my office. So sometimes those are very helpful documents. Police reports are always good. Of course, we all know that police are the most reliable observers in society. At least we'd like to think so. At least police are trained to be systematic observers of what happens, and police reports are very helpful in determining what happened in a given set of circumstances. Arrest records may be helpful. Again, a person may say, I've never been arrested, and we look at the rap sheet and it has 20 arrests and 10 convictions. And previous, this is very important in not only forensic kinds of evaluations, but also in clinical evaluations, past medical and psychological records are very important. When they're available, they help me determine how the person compares at this moment in time to at previous moments when they may have received treatment from other providers. So those are some of the kinds of collateral information that I find to be most helpful. Now, can anybody read any of the PowerPoint slides in the handout that I provided?
Yes.
Okay. It's not really necessary to read much of them, but there are a few things here that I think are kind of worth noting. Knowing what Charles Manson's MMPI looks like, that's I guess kind of interesting if you know anything about the MMPI. The reason that that slide is there is that that shows us what is called an MMPI profile. It shows what the elevations are on the different scales measured. And essentially, a psychologist will utilize information from that MMPI profile to give a standard view of how that person is functioning. And what this, for instance, the Manson MMPI here, if we knew nothing about the individual, we'd say that this is a seriously disturbed individual with strong sociopathic tendencies who experiences some very deviant kinds of thinking. Furthermore, he is completely antisocial and has no capacity whatsoever to really engage in good reciprocal relationships with other people. So that's the kind of those are the kinds of determinations that we may draw from some of the standardized data. I gave an example here of a drawing that was performed by a little girl who is a reactive attachment disorder case. Anybody here who has any experience with RADS kids? Anybody familiar with that concept?
Yes. Yes.
If you haven't, you will be working in dependency stuff, no question. What this picture does not tell me, it doesn't tell me anything about what this little girl is going to do, but it sure tells me a lot about how she sees herself. This picture is as good a representation as an 8-year-old child could give of the way she presents herself to other people. This big-eyed, Cupid doll-like child who everybody falls in love with. She is a wonderfully engaging and beautiful little girl who has a tendency to want to kill people that she lives with, and that's unfortunate. But there's a real mismatch between how this child presents and how the child actually behaves if you've been around her for a while. Projective drawings and all kinds of projective tests are open to a wide range of interpretations. I included a little Peanuts cartoon here that I think sums it up very well. Frame one, Charlie Brown is saying to Linus, this is a very nice drawing of a man, Linus. I notice, however, that you have drawn him with his hands behind his back, and you did that because you yourself have feelings of insecurity, to which Linus responds, I did that because I can't draw hands. And that's the problem that we face. Sometimes what we see is not reflective of a deep psychological process, but of some simpler explanation, such as the child can't draw. And the child may not be able to draw because of other cognitive problems, and then we need to look at that through a different set of filters. But when psychologists are forced to base too much of their evaluations on projective techniques, such as the drawings, the sentence completions, although I like sentence completions because that's the child saying what the child feels. They may not always write what they really feel, but what they say there is sometimes very instructive. And the Rorschach test, which
Can
is...
Can I ask you a question
yes.
about the self-portrait of the little girl?
Yes.
Is there anything about that self-portrait that would tell you what she was thinking in her mind about killing other people?
No, what this says is that she wants to be loved. She wants to be liked. And she presents herself in that way. She is, you know, I hate these kinds of interpretations, but as you see her outstretched hands, this is a child who is saying, I'm open, I'm vulnerable, approach me. It's a child who's, you know, she has all the characteristics of a very vulnerable child who is inviting you into her life and inviting herself into yours. And this is the way the child behaves. What this test does not give us is any indication of her having homicidal impulses.
I see. Thank you.
I would like to, if there is anybody who could look at that blind and say, well, this is a child who has strong homicidal impulses, I'd sure want to know how they knew that. Because I don't see dynamically anything in that drawing that would predict the kind of danger that this child puts people in.
I see. Thank you.
Okay. I just wanted to include some samples of the different kinds of things that we utilize that go into an evaluation. The perfect evaluation would include both objective and projective tests. The reason that I say that is the objective tests give us the extent to which certain behaviors and certain qualities in the individual compare to what is normal. Now, what is normal? Can anybody tell me what normal is? See, I can tell you what we know what normal is. Normal can be quantified. Normal can be measured. Now, people don't always like the way that it's done. But it can be done. For instance, if we wanted to know what is the normal weight of everybody talking on the phone, what we would all do is we would submit our weight, and then we would submit our weights to statistical analysis, determine what the average, the mean is, the numerical average, compute what the standard deviation is, and that's a measure of the degree to which the individual scores differ from one another, the individual numbers. And then we could determine statistically that the normal range for our weight is that mean plus or minus one standard deviation. Anybody who's more than a standard deviation over is unusually heavy. Anyone who is a standard deviation under is unusually light. Again, that's by the numbers. It is statistical. It is not necessarily the way that we think of normal in terms of whether what a person does in a given moment is normal behavior or not. It is the way we can measure normal, though. I like to have a mixture of objective tests that are able to compare given types of behavior to a population norm, and as a result, come up with the extent to which an individual differs from what is average or normal in most people. The projective tests give us then an indication of how the child feels about himself, herself, other people, family drawings are very instructive, just in terms of seeing who the child includes in their family drawing and in what context. If we see a drawing in which father is twice as large as all the other figures and is coming after them with knives, I think that tells us something about how the child sees that family. Those are helpful. There's no way to measure those responses. There's no way to submit them to statistical analysis, but they give us an indication of what's going on in that child's thought processes. And so when I have that mixture of objective and projective measures, I think I can do a better job in evaluating the child. That's especially true with a child. I don't use projectives as much with adults because there are so many good verbal response-based tests that we can use with adults that probably are going to give us better information. But with kids, I like a mixture of both. Also, in testing kids, it is really helpful to use objective tests when we can. Most of the objective tests with children require the response of an adult, a parent. Kids in foster care don't always have a parent available, and that parent's response may not be valuable to us. On the other hand, they usually do have foster parents, they usually do have teachers, and there are report measures that we can use that enable people who observe the child to rate the child's behavior and give us some objective measures. I've seen before where in one setting a person says this child's hyperactive, this child is constantly into things, and then when I look at the teacher report form, I find that their behavior in school is quite normal. And it makes me wonder what's going on in that home, that the child is so able to behave normally in school and yet they're very deviant at home. So those kinds of tests I find to be very helpful. And again, anytime I can mix in as much objective data as I can, it gives me much greater clarity in terms of what I can state in my report.
How young can you test a child?
Pardon?
What's the youngest age you can start testing a child?
Well, that varies.
Depends on the test,
pardon?
Or the child, or...
It varies based on who you ask, among other things. There are people who do what they call psychological evaluations on children of two. I question that. There are some cognitive measures, such as the Bayley scales, that can be given to children that young. And we can get, on the basis of those, we can get some information that is valuable. We can also get some information based upon parental reports of very young children and subject them to some quantitative analysis. But for my purposes, I do not like to evaluate children under five. Below that age, the things that we gather through objective and projective testing are in my opinion, far too suspect. I think at that point in time, you're much below, certainly below the age of four, in my opinion. You're going to get most of your information from observing and interacting with the child, and observing and interacting with the child and the child's caregivers. And so it becomes a different kind of evaluation. It's not so much an individual evaluation as an evaluation of the way that child relates to the people around her. Think about it for a minute. Up until the age of three, children are very, very dependent upon adults to do most things for them. Children don't do a whole lot that involves any meaningful activity that is really independent. They're going to draw people in to their lives in large part. They have not really individuated all that well. And so when you're talking about very young children, the evaluation of the child usually involves evaluating the child interacts with people that they're with. And so the concept of an individual psychological evaluation does not apply real well. As I say, there are some people who differ with me, and they do psychological evaluations on 2 and 3 year olds. I don't. And that's because I'm just not sure that this same approach is all that valuable with that young a child. And that's pretty much my opinion. Some share that opinion, and there are a few who don't. The bottom line, as I call it, is what we try to produce when we produce a psychological evaluation. We gather a whole lot of data and sift that data, the data from the interview, from collateral sources, and from the psychological testing, try to sift that down into a clinical impression, and that clinical impression should orient itself toward a standardized system of classification. And the one that is most commonly used, the one that is the standard for the profession, is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. We're currently on the fourth edition of that book, which is published by the American Psychiatric Association. And what it is a book of names, basically. It is the nomenclature that we use in describing problems. The DSM-IV is not really a textbook in the sense that it does not research the individual classifications of mental disorders. What it does is describe them. It gives you a name and a description and a basis upon which to say that a person that I have evaluated suffers from dysthymic disorder, which is chronic low-grade depression, or a personality disorder such as passive-aggressive personality disorder or schizoid personality disorder. It gives me a basis upon which to say these are the problems that the person has, if they have problems. The two categories, it's a multi-axial diagnosis. There are 5 axes that we utilize for classifying a person's functioning. Axis 1 deals with acute mental illnesses or syndromes, such as dysthymic disorder or schizophrenia or reactive attachment disorder or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Those are acute mental illnesses that present themselves in the moment. Axis 2 is reserved for chronic conditions, and there are 2 main kinds of chronic conditions that may be classified under Axis 2. One is personality disorders. This is a classification primarily for people 18 years of age and older. It is usually not applied to children, and it's not appropriately applied to children. But the personality disorders are long-standing maladaptive patterns of interpersonal relations that are at least of 2 years' duration. The other classification, the other category of classification under Axis 2 is mental retardation. We may classify mild, moderate, or severe mental retardation, or we may classify borderline intellectual functioning. Borderline functioning is just what it implies. It's the borderline between what is normal range and what is classified as retarded. Axis 3 refers to any medical problems that are known about the individual. My policy, because I'm a psychologist, I am not a physician, is I do not independently diagnose medical problems. If a person comes into my office and says they have diabetes and they have phlebitis and they have hypertension, I might note that by report, diabetes, hypertension by report. More often, I will simply say that I'm deferring on Axis 3 because I'm not independently diagnosing those. If I have medical records that document those conditions, I may list them, particularly if they are important to the individual's psychological functioning. If a person has had a massive set of injuries from a car accident and they've been in the hospital for 6 months in a full body cast, I would expect them to be depressed. So my diagnosis under Axis 1 might be a mood disorder or depression associated with medical condition, and the medical condition then I would list under Axis 3. It's the same with a person who suffered a head injury. We may list them under Axis 1 as having a dementia, that is a decline in mental functioning, attributable to a closed head injury. And under Axis 3, if I have documented, I would list the closed head injury. And that's how Axis 3 plays a part in the multiaxial diagnosis. Axis 4 is simply a category for describing psychosocial stress. Removal from a parent, psychosocial stress. Having a child removed, psychosocial stress. Being involved in a child dependency proceeding. Death of a loved one. Those are some of the stressors that we might see listed under Axis 4. Axis 5 is the Global Assessment of Functioning, or GAF. This is a 0 to 100 scale, which is a little bit misleading, because what we have is about 70 and up is normal functioning, and about below 70 is various grades of dysfunction. So if a person has a GAF of 50, it doesn't mean they're doing okay. A GAF of 50 means there's pretty significant impairment. A GAF of 25 means that they're probably grossly psychotic and cannot function. A GAF of 70 indicates that they're probably having at most mild transient problems. And that is the GAF scale. Now, before I go, and I want to reference, gave you some reports here, and I apologize in advance. In my attempt to provide clarity, I made a blunder, and I labeled two of these documents. I believe gave them both the designation of specimen one. So you probably have to ignore the labels that I put on as to which specimen is which. And I will refer to them, when I get around to these reports, I'll refer to them as Deborah. Number two is Dr. Phyllis, and number three is the Long Report. And I believe that you'll be able to tell which ones I'm referring to as I go through that. Does anybody have any questions or comments based upon my long-winded narration thus far?
I have just one question.
Sure.
In the global functioning, what does the A stand for?
Assessment. Global Assessment of Functioning.
Thank you.
What is the difference between a psychological eval and a psychiatric eval?
Oh, that's easy. I'm glad when I get easy questions. Psychiatric evaluation is done by a psychiatrist, and a psychological evaluation is done by a psychologist. That's the easy answer. The hard answer is that the psychological evaluation usually, not always, usually employs psychological tests. The psychiatric evaluation usually does not. Now, I say in both cases, it's usual. There are some psychiatrists who are trained in using psychological tests and do. There are some psychiatrists who are not trained in using psychological tests and use them inappropriately. There are psychologists who are trained in using psychological tests who don't always use them. And there are psychologists who are trained in using psychological tests who don't use them properly. But in general, psychiatrists tend not to use tests. They tend to rely more on history, tend to rely most on that interview, and most upon the mental status examination. Psychologists tend to put more weight on the testing than they do on the interview. And either a forensic psychiatrist or a forensic psychologist is likely to put more weight on collateral information. I don't know if that clarified or muddied the waters, but those are the general differences. And like I say, there are differences between a psychological evaluation that is done by a person who does primarily clinical work and someone who does primarily forensic work.
I think it's also important to point out that they're a medical doctor by training and can prescribe medication.
Yes.
Are there any axes that cannot be remedied by a parent?
Any axes that cannot?
Right.
You're talking about from the multi-axial diagnosis?
Right.
Well, the one thing that, and people hate to hear it because it's, you know, we're supposed to believe that everybody can change, but the things that do not change readily are axis 2 diagnoses. Retardation tends not to get better, and personality disorders, it's interesting that they're kind of lumped on the same axis with retardation. Personality disorders tend to be very resistant to change, and so they are long-standing, deeply ingrained. And so the axis 2 diagnoses do not change much as a rule. Anything else before we look at some of these reports? Then we'll look at some of the reports. Now, can anybody see, as we look at report number one, which just the name at the top says Deborah, can anybody, based on some of the information that I just kind of blurted out in machine gun fashion over the past half hour or so, see what the basic number one flaw with this three-page document is? Well, I'll tell you what I think is the number one flaw, and then I can go down and give you a couple of ways in which this thing clearly does not fit my definition for a psychological evaluation. First off, the person was in a dependency case and they were court-ordered to get a psychological evaluation. So the person went to the counselor that they were seeing, and she said, oh, okay, I'll do that. And she called what she is doing in, on line two here, a psychological assessment. That's number one. So she's not exactly calling it a psychological evaluation. Also, we know that this person is not a psychologist. They're a licensed marital and family therapist. So they've got no business doing a psychological evaluation. Then we go and we look, there are some signs here that this may not be the kind of evaluation the judge was looking for. What do you make of a person who is evaluating, and I'm going to say this tentatively because I know some good people that use this form, but what do you think about a report in which the evaluator repeatedly refers to an adult by her first name? What does that sound like? Sounds like they're kind of friendly with them, doesn't it? Now, can we assume that a report is really objective if we also assume that the evaluator likes them well enough to use their first name? And it's not a hard and fast thing. As I say, I know some pretty good people who refer to adult evaluees by their first name, but it just sounds a little too chummy, number one. Secondly, this thing is very impressionistic. And it comes down to, and let's say that you were your guardians. Let's say that you're protecting this child, and this evaluation is going to make you feel good or bad about putting the child with the person that gets evaluated. And how do you like this report? If you look at it, does this rest your mind at ease that the proposed caregiver here has really gone through an extensive evaluation? Does anybody have any questions about whether maybe this is kind of a Valentine?
There doesn't appear to be any collateral information.
There's no collateral information. There's no testing. It doesn't really exactly say how these opinions are arrived at. But basically, it's a very flow, it's a Valentine. It's a very flowery description of why this is a very wonderful woman, and she's just going to do a great job with this little child, based entirely on information that was under the control, and this is important, under the control of the person who is being evaluated.
Also, I don't notice any recommendations. Do they usually make recommendations at the
one would hope.
Okay.
Yeah, one would hope. There should be recommendations of some kind. I mean, that's the whole idea. The whole idea is, what's the problem? And if there is a problem, again, it helps if you know a little bit about what the law is in the dependency courts. You know that there's kind of a statutory mandate that puts a bias in the direction of reunification. So the purpose of an evaluation technically is to let the judge know what it would take to fix the case so that the child could be reunified. And you're right, this doesn't give us any indications. Now let's take a look for a minute at what I intended to be specimen two, which is Dr. Phyllis. Dr. Phyllis produces a report of about 7 or 8 pages. It is, we look at the categories of information. This is pretty pretty close to what I gave you earlier about sort of a structure. She talks about what the presenting problem is. She gives a history that appears to be based upon some, you know, mainly what the person says. There is a mental status examination. There's an administration of some tests. There is collateral information in the form of visitation center notes, an interview with the child's foster mother, an interview with the DCF caseworker. She looks at videotapes. So basically, she's taking a look at collateral information. She gives a summary and recommendations. And at the end, she gives a multiaxial diagnosis. She considers this person to be functioning pretty well with a GAF of 70. She notes the mitral valve prolapse. She notes the removal of children from the home. It's an appropriate DSM-4 diagnosis. There are a couple of problems. Now, I've got a technical problem with the report. Can anybody voice any other problems that they might see, or is this generally a good, do you think this is a report that you could use and you could go into court with? Any impressions?
Well, I haven't had a chance to read the whole thing, but
okay.
She's got the Access 1 deferred.
Yeah, she's not calling a shot there.
And that's obviously a pretty important piece of information, I would think.
Yeah. She says, I'm not sure if she's got a mental illness or not. She says, I am sure that she has mental retardation. Now, that poses some problems. Now, first off, does being mentally retarded automatically mean that a person can't raise their child?
No.
All right, but basically, she says here, if I can find it, it says, specifically, Mrs. Mom is functioning in the borderline range of intelligence with a verbal IQ of 74, a level which will negatively affect her ability to appropriately parent a child. And then she goes on to say in her Access 2 diagnosis, mild mental retardation. Well, first off, and this is a technical issue, and you will never know in advance whether somebody's going to make a mistake like this. This is just something that you may one day attack under cross-examination, or if it's your witness, you're going to find them attacked under cross-examination, and there's nothing you can do to help them. A verbal IQ of 74 is not diagnostic of mental retardation. She correctly states on the next to last page that this is in the borderline range of intelligence, not mentally retarded. To give you an idea of how important that distinction is, if you have someone that you want to get services from the state of Florida as a retarded individual, they need it, they can't function independently, and you send them to the, I forget what they're called now, they used to be developmental disabilities. If they get an IQ of 71, guess what? They don't get services. They don't get benefits. If it's Social Security, IQ of 71, no benefits. IQ of 69, mildly retarded, they get benefits. That's a huge distinction. And it's a great mistake, in my opinion, to mislabel this lady mildly mentally retarded, especially when we look at the other test scores, some of which are actually low average. Our schools in Florida are graduating people from high school with 74 IQs, folks. So if a 74 IQ means you can't parent a child, we got problems. So this report, even though it's good in respects, it contains some problems, contains some inaccuracies. If she thought IQ was so important, why did she only give half of the test? She only gave half of the Wechsler Adult Intelligence Scale. Only the verbal portions. So, and why she did that is not really explained. So this is a report that looks good on the surface, but it's got some flaws that may not stand up under a lot of scrutiny. The final report, I want to give you a caveat here. Report 3, all you have to do is pick it up and hold it in your hand, and that tells you a lot. This report contains everything, including the kitchen sink. It has everything that I described except the multiaxial diagnosis at the end. But this is one of the most thorough psychological evaluations you will ever see. Now, therein lies our problem. You look at the amount of, she summarizes what she did here. She did 11 hours of testing and observation of the child. She reviewed records for 25 hours. She did 5 hours of collateral interviews. This lady evaluated this kid. The problem is, do not ever expect to see this in the real world. Because if she put in, was it 41 hours on this case, at the rate that people are reimbursed for psychological evaluations, she would not be able to pay the rent on her office. So I suspect that this evaluation, as absolutely thorough as it is, this was probably produced as part of her fellowship or residency. Basically, her work was graded on the basis of this report. And I would think that she was given very high grades for thoroughness because she really has this case nailed. The problem is, the person that did this evaluation is probably in the future not going to do them quite so thoroughly because it's just not really practical. Other than that, I don't have too much to say about it. This is certainly, this third report is certainly an example of how you could theoretically completely evaluate an individual and come up with so much information that you would probably have to have a second evaluation done of the evaluation just to figure out what the key points are. The only thing I would have approaching a criticism is that there is so much information here contained in the last 3 or 4 pages where it's summarized that it may be a little bit hard to get all of this information across to the court. So I would say if you have a psychologist who produces such a lengthy report, I would encourage, and if they're your witness, you sit down with them and you really try to parse out the high points so that you don't end up with 6 hours worth of testimony trying to defend each and every little thing that's in here. Does that make sense to you? Because I don't want to make it sound like I'm being critical of this report. It's just that it does pose some complications when it comes time to boiling it down to a few simple factors that are going to be digestible by the court.